Those who watch a lot of movies, particularly those of the art house variety, will often be alert to cross-reference to other films, especially famous ones, and the key motifs of other great movie directors. The director of what you are watching loves to drop in clues like this to make sure that you're alert, and also to provide an ironic take on what at first appears to be a straightforward story. There is more going on in the narrative that first meets the eye, and you get more out of the movie if you can pick up on these cross-reference clues. Like any satisfying story, it opens up fresh perspectives on what went before. It offers new takes on previous sections of the story and a richer understanding of the overall plot and where it's going. Sometimes literature's like this, as is the Bible also. And the New Testament narratives are often full of these ironic cross-references to what went before. That's why I've entitled this sermon, The Passion of Christ, the Time of Ironic Reversals. The Gospels have been called passion narratives with an extended introduction that precedes them. In other words, the healing miracles, the exorcisms, the vivid teaching, and the calling of the disciples are a warm-up, a curtain raiser, and a preparation for the decisive events that bring about the death of the Messiah, and thereby a radical shift in the human story. They give you the interpretive keys to the crucial part of the story, the passion narratives, that it is our business this morning to enter into with heart and mind, to understand them with clear appreciation, and to apply them to our lives with rigour and vigour. These last few Sundays, the Gospel readings have focused on the junction points between the introduction of the Passion, the Lazarus story, the Transfiguration, and Peter's confession of faith. Let's start there. Jesus, you may recall, had initiated a conversation with the disciples about who he really is, inviting them to offer a title or a descriptor of his role, which of course would inevitably have many reference points from the Hebrew Scriptures. The disciples offer a series of guesses based on folklore heroes of Israel's past or from great prophetic figures who might have parallels with what Jesus is on about. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Peter gets it right. A confession of faith and an acute theological descriptor based not on his own sharp insights into the person he's been spending a lot of time with, but rather because he is for that brief period of time Spirit-filled in his key utterance. The spirit of knowledge and of wisdom and of the fear of the Lord has entered into him and led him to the truth of the matter. What is more, this is a confession of faith that is offered in a spirit of admiration and of gratitude and of receptivity to what his beloved friend is trying to do and be. When the high priest asks Jesus at his trial, and I'm going to the Matthean passion narrative here. By the living God, I charge you to tell us, are you the Messiah, the Son of God? He is not asking a spirit-filled question. The question is correct in its content and very much to the point, but it's asked in a spirit of condemnation and of close-mindedness. Nor are he or his fellow council members in any way disposed to take seriously the answer they receive. From now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of God and coming on the clouds of glory. This is merely ammunition for the summary of sentence of guilt and of a recommendation for judicial execution. So this is a parallel conversation to the one Jesus had with his disciples on the theme of his true identity, one that operates in reverse. There's great irony in the fact that the high priest is accurate in asking exactly the right question and getting to the heart of the matter right away, but the spirit in which the question is put and in which the answer is received is so different, both in intent, content, and tone. It's useful to note also what led the high priest to ask his pointed question. In New Zealand law, a person of interest to the police who was being interrogated by them has the right to remain silent. Jesus is also silent in the face of trumped-up charges and of false evidence brought against him. This exasperates the high priest and the council and leads to question that sets off a deadly train of consequences. But the silence of Jesus is not about trying to derail the deeply flawed judicial process he's undergoing. This deliberate silence is about Jesus intentionally inserting himself into the suffering servant Psalms in Isaiah. He must have reflected at some length in his earlier days on those passages in Isaiah in which the servant of the Lord speaks of his sufferings having a representative function in which he personally takes on the sins of his people and then takes them away through his suffering. Now Jesus both applies them to himself and enters into the living out of them in these last few hours of his life. This mysterious section of the Hebrew Scriptures comes alive in its fulfillment, takes on its fullest and intended meaning, and provides the script lines for the death of the Messiah. Certainly, the early Christians and the authors of the New Testament got the message, drew the parallels, and made explicit reference to this key theme in the Passion of Christ. This looking back into the Hebrew Scriptures to draw out their true and fullest meaning goes right back to the beginning, to the book Genesis, the story of the Garden of Eden. It pivots off that incident in the Lucan Passion narrative in which the two thieves, crucified on either side of Jesus, enter into a brief dialogue with him, one reviling him and the other who takes a more positive approach. This earns those famous words from Jesus, "Today you will be with me in paradise." The gardeners among you will be delighted to hear that some versions of the Bible use the word paradise to translate the Hebrew word gan, which means garden. The Garden of Eden was a paradise, a place in which there was no trace of evil, while its leafy glades were filled with abundant life and its beauty, joy and blessedness. After that terrible misunderstanding which Adam and Eve eat of the tree for knowledge of good and evil, God takes drastic action. Genesis reads, "He drove out the man, and at the east of Eden, God placed a cherubim and a flaming sword which turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life." The death of Christ on the cross and its playing out of the script of the suffering servant Psalms has as one of its most dramatic effects a reaching back to the time of beginnings and makes a major change happen in the mythic story of the shutting off the gates of paradise. I love the way Thomas Wynandy describes it. Before the gate of paradise, a cherubim has been discharged from a sentinel post and the flaming sword has been extinguished. And once again, the fallen but now redeemed race of Adam can walk with God in union with Jesus, the Son of Adam and the Father's Son, and eat of the tree of life. In this back and forth rhythm between the mythic past and the present ugly reality of the grim death on Golgotha, the greatest ironic reversal all takes place. One of the medieval hymn writers loved to dwell on. As Jesus is raised on the cross, he transforms this evil symbol of capital punishment deterrent into first the tree of good and evil that started all the trouble in the first place, and then into the paradisial tree of life. The redeemed, those who follow Christ, can eat of the fruit of the tree of life and thereby receive the life that really is life. I conclude with two verses on this theme from one of my favourite hymn writers, the 6th century poet and bishop, Venantius Fortunatus. "O tree of beauty, tree of light, O tree with royal purple dight, elect on whose triumphal breast those holy limbs should find their rest, on whose dear arms so widely flung the weight of this world's ransom hung, the price of humankind to pay, and spoil the spoiler of his prey." Spoken in the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.